You're listening to Mom and Doc Talk, where we talk all things healing pans and pandas with an emphasis on homeopathy.
Hi, it's Jody, the mom of the Mom and Doc Talk podcast. We're taking a short pause this summer to enjoy our families and hope you're doing the same. We're also doing some prep work for season two of the Mom and Doc Talk podcast. We've got some really exciting episodes coming your way starting August 27th. In the meantime, we wanted to give you guys the opportunity to catch up on any episodes that you might have missed or take a break. We know you need a break. You deserve a break. Here's a rebroadcast of one of our most popular episodes. We hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to Mom and Doc Talks. We are joined today by a very dear friend of mine, Dr. Karen Lamb, and we've got so much to talk about. This is really, it's an episode that we kind of had moms in mind, dads too, but the truth is it can really be for the whole family, and I'm just really excited to talk about the topics that Dr. Lamb has so much expertise in today. We've got so much to talk about. I'm going to dive right in really quickly with her introduction so we can get to the meat of the conversation. So Dr. Karen Lamb is a naturopathic medical doctor and a licensed professional counselor focusing on integrative care for the highly sensitive persons, HSPs, physiological, interpersonal, emotional, and energetic needs. She has been in the mental health field for over 20 years as a clinician and professor. Her clinical skills and focus include homeopathy, botanical and nutritional medicine, as well as mindfulness-based internal family systems and cognitive behavioral therapies. Her specialty is finding and attending to the nutritional and emotional imbalances that arise in the depleted HSP body. These imbalances tend to show up as chronic physical and/or psychological diseases that often have natural and gentle solutions. Her goal is to work together to design a health plan that allows her clients to tap into the power of their sensitivity. As a highly sensitive clinician, she understands the importance of physical and emotional support to achieve optimal productivity and quality of life. Dr. Lamb, welcome. I have to tell you, I love that you focus on tapping into the power of sensitivity, because so many times sensitivity can be seen as a disability in many ways, like, but it really has like this amazing superpower if you know how to effectively work with it. So I can't wait to talk to you about that. We didn't really include a whole lot of your expertise in trauma, but you have a lot of training and expertise in trauma therapies as well. So we're going to double tap here and get you to share your expertise on both sides. I'm hoping that we can start with a little bit about trauma, but before we do that, just tell us a little bit about yourself and the work that you do.
Thank you for touching on that, actually. Yes, the power of the sensitivity is my absolute passion. That's exactly why I do what I do. It is kind of reframing the narrative that we've been exposed to our whole lives, which is you have to learn how to not be sensitive. You have to learn how to, you know, fit your star-shaped sensitive person peg into this kind of boring, regular circle-shaped hole. And, you know, the damage that that does, of course, is part of the problem. So I love that you touched on that. And trauma is definitely part of the reason, it is the absolute reason why I started to look into sensitivity. So I'm sure we'll get into that. But I am a sensitive person myself. And I happen to also be a naturopathic doctor and a licensed counselor. And my passion really is kind of bringing all of these things together. So to treat the very unique medical and psychological needs of sensitive people, it's just what makes me tick. I absolutely love it.
Yeah, I have to say, as somebody, as a person who comes from the background in like the military and like the Midwest, and I'm just barely Gen X, but I am Gen X. And so like a lot of the ways that, you know, like I've lived a lot of lives, that a lot of areas in my life that are like suck it up and drive on. And I have been a person who has felt like anytime somebody calls me sensitive, that it felt like an insult. And you have really helped me see and like shift the way that I relate to things. So anyway, like I said, let's start with trauma because it's such a big topic for the parents in our community. And so many professionals that I stuck with get like sort of stuck on the big T traumas for diagnosis. Like a lot of people hear that. I've heard it personally. And so I'm curious if you could talk to us about how our bodies and emotions respond to like the little T traumas that aren't necessarily like threats to your life and your safety, but that are really, really stressful, hard things that you deal with on repeat all day, every day, including the type of things that you go through when you have a kid with PANS or that you are a kid with PANS.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that that's really little T's in this population are such a huge consideration in health and recovery, because when a child is dealing with these, you know, in the conventional world, in the conventional medical world, are dealing with these symptoms that are so, in their minds, very vague and very difficult to identify and classify and certainly treat. What can happen is a chronic series of invalidation and chronic exposure to these little T's. And that it happens, of course, for the child as well as the parents. And so you're seeing this whole system, this family system being exposed to the invalidation in the conventional medical world, not always, obviously, but oftentimes, you know, with this group of people. And that has a cumulative effect. So these little T's are happening over an extended period of time, little traumas, but they just keep chipping away at the family's resources, physiological resources, psychological resources, financial resources, all the resources, right? And then that can start to lead to hopelessness and symptoms of depression and start to evolve into the picture of maybe not quite PTSD, but potentially. I mean, little T's can certainly contribute to a full-blown diagnosable picture of post-traumatic stress disorder. So it is a very important topic to discuss with PANS and PANDAS, kids and parents. And then the other component of trauma in this population is also going to be parents who, you know, are coming into this journey with their children with their own history of trauma, right? So maybe medically related, maybe not. And if it is medically related, then that adds a whole other layer of complexity for them. But what's, I think, worth mentioning here is when people who are just, you know, they're just living their lives and now they have a child with PANS, PANDAS, is now coming into a situation, a really demanding situation with a dysregulated nervous system. Mm-hmm. And that is going to have an effect on how effective they feel in advocating for their child and, you know, being able to get the care that they need in a really difficult system to navigate with something that is as challenging as PANS and PANDAS. So specific to that group, I think it's very, very relevant. Trauma, of course, is going to have an inhibitory effect on the immune system and recovery. So that's super relevant. I have a lot to say about all the things related to trauma, so maybe you need to step in and kind of guide me. But if you just let me go, I will just keep going. So I'll pause in case you have any questions.
Oh, not specifically about that. I just love that we're having this conversation because I have never heard anyone in the PANS community have this conversation. And I feel like the trauma that we go through, our entire families go through, you know, diving into that is to me is not exciting is not the right word, but so I could just listen to you talk all day long.
It's really needed. It's just really needed. I love that you acknowledge that people are likely coming in with some amount of their own experience that could be trauma that they are that they're managing, that was at a level that they were managing. And then the whole experience of dealing with PANS and just the challenge of feeling like things are out of control in your home, to then also being disregarded and dismissed by the medical community and not finding answers for your kiddo and all of that. And then Dr. Lam, I'm sure that you know, like with PANS too, like it itself can be traumatizing because it's like this huge flare of like really intense symptoms that then goes away for a while and then comes back again. And then the healing process can like re-traumatize people sometimes because like they finally start to get relief because a lot of times people get to homeopathy when they've just gotten to the place where they're kind of stuck in like a prolonged flare, or their baseline is just not great. And so then they start to heal and they get relief, but because homeopathy works to help to stimulate the body to heal, it's not just like this blanket that just covers things. So there's flares and everything in the healing process. It's 2 to 3 steps forward and 1 step back. And those 1 steps back are so hard for parents because they've finally gotten some relief that they're feeling okay. And then it just like brings it all back up. So anyway, let's go into a little bit more detail. We've got lots of questions for you on details.
Mm-hmm. So talk to us about the role that genetics play in PTSD and trauma and being a highly sensitive person.
So genetics, the way that I like to define trauma is when our resources, our available resources are basically outnumbered by the demand of the trauma on the body. So the more depleted someone's system is nutritionally, emotionally, or energetically before experiencing a trauma, the more likely they are to experience long-term PTSD symptoms from that adverse event, right? So if somebody is starting off at a deficit, and then they experience a traumatic event or T's, little T's, right? A lot of little T's, then they are more likely to experience significant or long-term symptoms of trauma or even post-traumatic stress disorder. So I'm talking about this because genetically, they're sensitive people are known to be about 20 to 30% of the population. And it is known to be a genetic trait. And so sensitive people are going to, because we process so much information so quickly, we tap into our resources more than non-highly sensitive people, leaving us, if we're not actively trying to replenish those nutrients, leaving us at a deficiency just as our baseline. You know, so we're starting off at a deficit if we are not intentionally tending to those things. So there isn't necessarily a gene that we know of. I mean, there's so much we don't know about genetics, but that we know of that makes us more susceptible to trauma. But I do know that sensitive people and anyone with an illness, any kind of chronic disease, is going to start off with a nutritional or energetic, you know, psychological deficit because you're just worn out. You know, you are working so much harder just to get through your day. And that makes us, that's a predisposition to trauma.
Yeah. Let's pause for a second and talk about what a trauma response actually looks like. So I know it can involve the mind, your emotions, and your body. So share with us what people could be looking for just in case they're not sure.
So the telltale sign of a big T trauma is going to be you know, severe dissociation, like flashbacks where you feel like you're re-experiencing that again. However, in little T's, it can present as a more subtle form of dissociation. So that can look like somebody staring blankly in the middle of a conversation. They're just kind of staring off at the wall. Maybe they, if they're of driving age, they're driving and they realize 2 or 3 blocks down the road that they have no recollection of having driven, you know, the last mile. Or in times of really high stress, maybe there is just a dissociation or a disconnect from the body. So maybe that can look like impulsive behaviors to, in an effort to regulate the nervous system, like throwing things, under eating because they just have no hunger cues that they're connecting to in their bodies, or overeating. Basically it could be one of many, many, impulsive behaviors that are an effort to regulate the nervous system. So body responses can be agitation or restlessness. Sleep, of course, is a really common concern with acute or chronic trauma responses. So that could be nightmares. It can be bedwetting. It can be frequent waking because cortisol levels are going to be higher because of that that response, that stress response, and cortisol is our awake hormone. So that means that it should be low at night. But for people who are experiencing high amounts of stress or in a period of a traumatic response, cortisol will go up at night, and that can have really serious effects on sleep, which is just adding so much to an already complicated situation, because now you're not resting and you're not refueling. So people can have heart palpitations, muscle pain, brain fog, difficult periods. Emotionally, it can look like irritability, anxiety, excessive guilt that maybe doesn't really make sense, but our brain tries to find ways to make that make sense. And I think that as a parent, that probably really, you know, rings true, just generally speaking. And then when you have a child that's not feeling well, boy, that's brutal, right? Yeah. Yeah, there's many others, but those are kind of the main trauma emotions and physical responses.
So you've mentioned a whole lot of things that could be part of trauma, and they could be part of other conditions as well. Do you see that yes. when trauma comes up, that there tends to be more like episodic flares of these things, where they're more intense for a period of time than they're mm-hmm. like are at their baseline? Mm-hmm. Or is it more of a steady state and just could be confused for something else and perhaps have been misdiagnosed as something else?
Yeah, that's where I think as naturopathic doctors, we get to be, we get to really shine, because we dig really deep into understanding what this looks like for people, because the discerning between those two can be really, really tricky. And really, it is only in a really wonderful collaborative relationship that we can discern between the two. You know, if somebody has an active trigger for their trauma, you know, that's when we're going to expect to see a lot of these symptoms flare. But mm-hmm. if the trauma was, or the little big T or lots of those little T's present for an extended period of time, it's possible that this could be a chronic state yeah. where they are experiencing muscle pain and palpitations and insomnia almost every day of their lives for years and years and years.
Yeah. I would say that I see that a lot with Pan's parents, especially moms, but some dads too, where they can be in a chronic state and they don't realize how much of it is yeah. trauma related until their kiddo is getting better, then has a big step back, and then they have a massive flare. And they, even though their kid is substantially better in many cases than they were at their worst, mom or dad feels like they're back into the place where they were at their absolute worst, mm-hmm. in spite of the fact that things are still actually pretty good, just not as good as they had been. So I think that for Pan's parents, a lot of times you're in that place where it's become sort of your chronic steady state, and it's not clear that it's trauma until you have an exposure that shows, oh, this is really all connected.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't have a child with Pan's or Pandas. I have a highly sensitive child, and our own issues that we deal with, because that's what parenting is. And it just takes over your body. Like, you are in survival mode for them, right? Mm-hmm. And yeah. it's unreal how, and it just, it's a threat. Whatever the threat is, you know, you're going to take care of your baby. And it's very difficult to have any energy left over in those moments to have any self-reflection. So I completely understand what you're describing.
What about, can somebody heal from trauma when they're still dealing with acute stress?
That's a good question. I would love to say yes. I would love to be able to say that it is absolutely possible. Unfortunately, healing happens in a state of safety, right? We have to be in a safe space to be able to really, truly, deeply heal. And so that makes it very difficult. If we're in an acute state of stress, it makes it very, very difficult to be able to tap into the nervous system setting that allows deep processing and healing of those hardships. What we focus on instead in those moments is crisis management. So whenever somebody is going through an extended period of prolonged stress, the goal is to make the situation not get worse. So we want to do as much as we can to keep ourselves from unknowingly making an already incredibly taxing circumstance that much more taxing and ultimately ending in a greater deficit, which makes us more susceptible for long-term, PTSD or other illnesses to come in.
I think this is one place where homeopathy can help. It's because homeopathy is not necessarily going to help you process the trauma. You need therapy of one sort or another, a trauma-focused therapy to help you process the trauma. But homeopathy can really help with the way you respond to trauma and the specific susceptibilities that you have, because we don't all have the same response to the same trauma, right? As Dr. Lamb was saying, some people overeat, some people undereat, some people get angry, some people get anxious, some people get sad. There's just very different ways that we can respond. So homeopathy can help to intervene with some of those ways that you're struggling when you're in that crisis management and like the still managing stress, but it maybe can't really be in a place of safety to do the work through therapy to fully heal. Would you agree with that, Dr. Lamb?
Absolutely. Oh my gosh. Yes. I cannot imagine my life professionally and personally without homeopathy as that, in crisis management and for chronic pictures and, constitutional rehabilitation, if you will. Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm curious if healing from trauma is something that you have to work through daily or forever, like an alcoholic has to work daily at being sober, or if there's a time that it really gets easier and you can truly just move past it.
Yeah. So it depends on the extent of the trauma, the severity of the experience, the time over which it occurred, if we're talking about little T's or big T's even, and the degree of deficiencies that those experiences caused in the body. So my mind always, conceptualizes somebody's healing in terms of their medical needs and their psychological needs. So psychologically speaking, these traumas can take a very, very long time to digest and to process if they had been going on for a long time. And medically, we have to nourish the body. We have to replenish all of the deficits that occurred during that time in order to be able to tend to the psychological pieces. So to answer your question, there are absolutely cases in which, oh my gosh, I've seen it happen in one session. Right. So somebody has an acute trauma and we are able to clear it entirely in one appointment. So, and then they move on with their lives, and perhaps maybe something happens later in their lives that is reminiscent of that. And maybe some of that comes back up. Grief is really sneaky like that. But generally speaking, they can just move on with their lives and it's, yeah, one and done kind of situation. When you're dealing with really long-term trauma, it can be something that is so easily triggered, right? So if the trauma is medical trauma based and you have to continue to go to medical appointments for different reasons, it keeps resurfacing. And what happens is through the process of trauma recovery and trauma healing, the individual will begin to feel empowered in their experience and they will deal with those situations differently, but they keep coming up. And so it's never something that completely goes away, but it does change over time.
Yeah. What about, how does trauma impact the healing trajectory? Is there a difference when trauma is different, like let's say 3 years of living in Pan's Hell or a lifetime of dealing with a traumatic upbringing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the amount of time definitely impacts how long and how complex the healing trajectory is. And I'd also like to mention that the more extensive it is, the greater impact it will have on every form of healing in their lives as well, right? So it's not just about this one trauma. It's also how comprehensively it is impacting the rest of their healing process. So it might take somebody who is dealing either with an acute trauma or a chronic trauma, you know, something that happened a long time ago, perhaps, and it's still active in their bodies, it will inhibit their immune system. And so even a simple cold might be more difficult to overcome for that person because of the type of hormones that are active in their bodies, like mentioning earlier, the cortisol spiking in the middle of the night, that suppresses immune function. So I know that's not exactly what your question was, but I think it's really important to put that out there, because sometimes I don't think it would make sense for people not to put these things together, you know, that I am dealing with this incredibly taxing and difficult and traumatic experience in my life, and, you know, dealing with Lyme disease or, you know, some sort of covert infection, or even just, I can't get over this cold. I have this cold like every other week or whatever. And so that then interferes with how quickly we can do that deep psychological work as well. So tending to both, in my experience, is an absolute necessity. That is part of why I do what I do and how it happened.
So tell us a little bit more about what you do. What therapies have you found to be most effective for trauma?
So my original background was in cognitive behavioral health or cognitive behavioral therapy. And that piece really shines at the crisis management portion. So that's going to be your, how do we not make a difficult situation worse? You know, so it's really practical interventions for coping with, I feel like I'm having a heart attack, you know, or I'm having a panic attack or whatever. What do we do in those moments to help regulate the nervous system so that you can then, you know, connect with your child and have children will, their little nervous systems will connect with adult nervous systems for support because their little nervous systems are still developing. And so when our nervous systems are so dysregulated because we are trying to create the best possible outcome for our children, or because we have previous trauma that we're bringing in to that situation, our child is now not able to connect to us and co-regulate. Mm-hmm. And then that is super sad, right? And I think that something that I've had to really work on in my own parenting is, yes, I want to advocate for my child. Yes, I want the absolute best care and the best everything for them. And at the end of the day, the absolute most important thing for me to do is to allow him to co-regulate his nervous system with mine. And so if I can do that, then I have, you know, this is a lot of practice because, you know, that's not where my mind goes. But if I can help him to feel safe in these times when he otherwise would feel really scared or really vulnerable, I'm winning. Mm-hmm. That's a win. And even if we're thinking about it in terms of, you know, healing immune system and structural biological healing, that nervous system setting is what is going to have the absolute greatest leverage, you know, in terms of his own internal healing, having a phenomenal alliance with his or her medical team is huge as well. I'm certainly not downplaying the importance of that. But sometimes I think that we can miss wonderful opportunities, you know, to be active participants in the healing of our children. So I digress. Let me get back to your question. So CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, dialectical behavioral therapy, these are really practical, hands-on, you know, super easy, tangible interventions to keep a crisis from getting worse. So that's kind of where those are my roots. It's based in mindfulness. And it was absolutely wonderful. The problem with that was that I could not get deep into trauma work with people. And we were just kind of going around and around in circles because it wasn't helping people to be able to digest those really huge life events. So from there, I became trained and certified in EMDR, eye movement and desensitization reprocessing. And that is a very well supported tons of literature, tons of research on the effects of this type of intervention between the control group of somebody, first responders is actually where it was developed. So the same first responders group would be given talk therapy, and the other first responders group from the same adverse event was provided with EMDR. And they did brain scans before the therapy and brain scans after the therapy. And what they saw is before the therapy, both brain scans showed a pattern of trauma. So the blood flow in the amygdala and the like reptile brain, which is this reactive survival mode, was bright red. And then after EMDR, the talk therapy, there was kind of some minor shifts in the blood flow pattern, but it was still pretty much reflecting a PTSD brain response, whereas EMDR group had completely reset back to a non-trauma response. So it's like startling and amazing and just really, really wonderful. And when I first started doing EMDR, I was a therapist before I became a naturopathic doctor. And when I became a naturopathic doctor, I started to refer to homeopathy as the EMDR of naturopathy, because I just thought of it as being so magical. Like, wow. How is that possible, right? Like one dose of one remedy and the clouds have lifted and I can see again, and oh my gosh, you know, it's just such a gift. So that's how I equate EMDR in the therapeutic world, in the psychological world.
I love that you say that. You've never actually shared that specific sentiment with me. But I think that that's really quite beautiful, and probably no surprise. So I won't go into any of the details, but I am one of the people. So Dr. Lam has done EMDR for me a couple of times for a couple of like acute things. And I was one of those people that like one session made substantial difference. And I just put it out there. I credit this woman with the fact that I was able to get pregnant on my last attempt to get pregnant. So there's two things that led to my daughter being a possibility, and it's homeopathy and EMDR. So it's no surprise that it shouldn't be surprising to me anyway that you equate the two to be so similar. Yeah. And I'm pretty sensitive to both.
Yeah, they are magical. There's one other thing that I'll mention about something being super, super important about therapies that are effective for trauma, and that is the therapeutic alliance with your provider. It is so, so critical. And I would say that that's actually just as important with our medical providers. And that's what I love about what you do, Dr. Barr, is that you have a team of really caring and compassionate and present doctors who can build those types of relationships. And that in and of itself is therapeutic, and it is helping to rewrite the narrative around the medical trauma.
Thank you.
100%. 100%. That is what got me through.
Yes. Yes.
It really is. It means a lot. So tell me, is there anything that we can do on our own to kind of downregulate that trauma response if working with a therapist isn't an option?
Yes. I think there's so much available now, right? Like I hate to be hyping social media, but there are so many wonderful things that have come from, you know, making this kind of information more readily available. If social media is your preferred platform, just make sure that the person is actually certified in what they do, that they've had, you know, extensive education and training and done their own work. Can we please talk about that for a second? That's super, super important. It's very dangerous. It can be, people can be very, very traumatizing to others if they haven't done their own work. And you can feel it, I feel like, when you get to know them, if it's something that you're looking for. So aside from social media, there actually, Dr. Nicole LaPera is somebody on social media. She's the integrative psychologist or holistic psychologist, I think is what her handle is. And she's really wonderful. She also has a book called How to Do the Work, which is really wonderful. So she's a good example of somebody who has done her own work. She talks about it, displays it all the time. And she's very well educated. Learning about boundaries, I think, is really important. When we experience trauma, we have less resources. I feel like a broken record here, but it's so important. If there's one thing people take from today, it's, you know, the resources, the deficiency in resources, the deficit is what leads to the extent of the symptoms. And so when we don't have a lot of energy, when we are feeling really depleted, and maybe even hopeless and exhausted, our boundaries become really shaky. And reinforcing that can help to preserve your energy, and it can help to preserve your the attention that you need in order to heal from the trauma. And that may relate specifically to the advocacy work that you're doing for your child, or it may relate to family of origin stuff, you know, where somebody is trying to tap into your energy resources, and ain't nobody got time for that when you are trying to heal from trauma and when you are trying to be there for your child. So boundaries, lots of things to do there. And it's a simply stated thing, but it is really complicated. I would say determining if you're a highly sensitive person. I think that it is, there are many reasons to suspect that sensitivity could be an underlying precursor to the extreme response to PANS and PANDAS. Could the root cause of the PANS and PANDAS make somebody look like a highly sensitive person and they actually truly are not? Yeah, that is possible. And in my experience, in my world, which is way more limited with PANS and PANDAS than it is in your world, but in the little bit that I've seen, I have yet to see somebody who wasn't a highly sensitive child even before they were diagnosed with PANS and PANDAS. I'm curious if you have something to say about that.
I definitely think that I have seen some that were not highly sensitive.
Yeah, I imagine so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I do think that there's, I mean, I think we're at this transitional place. I think we need to start shifting soon to talking about HSPs. But the reality is, it sounds like there's just so much overlap. Right. Mm-hmm. And that like, it sounds like trauma can make somebody become even temporarily a highly sensitive person, even if they're not necessarily genetically wired that way, that right. They can appear to be a more highly sensitive person and likely have similar needs to somebody who is just by nature a highly sensitive person, as can many chronic medical conditions can just like increase people's sensitivity is what I'm understanding. You can completely correct me if I'm wrong there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I think one of the reasons we wanted to bring you on is because I see so many people that end up being like, okay, the PANS is resolving and we still have a lot of things that feel challenging, but I think that these are related to just how you are wired that is different than PANS itself. And like, because you've had the experience with PANS, it can be like a hard transition to understand where PANS has stopped and being a highly sensitive person has started, and the needs obviously change for those things. So we've already talked a little bit about the role that homeopathy can play in healing from trauma and from acute stress situations. You know, I've shared what my opinion is. Is there anything you'd like to add to what I have shared before?
Oh gosh, I just love homeopathy. I love it so much. It's amazing. Yeah, the way that I place homeopathy in treatment plans and conceptualize somebody's healing journey is that homeopathy helps to simplify a person's whole picture. So when somebody comes in and, you know, because I work with sensitive people and trauma is almost always a part of their whole picture, almost always, the picture can get really complicated really, really quickly. And we're dealing with so many layers. So, you know, where is that symptom coming from? Is it coming from like what we were discussing earlier? Is it a symptom of trauma? Is it that their body, their nervous system is stuck in this fight or flight response and they can't shift out of it? And that's what's causing the palpitations versus they actually have a cardiovascular disease or, you know, something else that's contributing to the palpitations or whatever the symptom may be. So what I love about homeopathy is that it helps to take those layers out. Yeah. So many of those layers so quickly. And now you're like, here is this thing and here is this thing. And you get a really clear understanding, even if there's still multifaceted, right? You can still have four or five things going on at the same time, but homeopathy really, it takes this really blurry and chaotic picture. And it gives you these really clearly defined, you know, targets in the treatment. And that is priceless.
Yeah. I would say in my experience, so I know enough about these therapies through conversations with you, continuing education you have done, and some others as well. And then my own personal experience, to know enough to say, okay, this is likely to be a beneficial thing for you, but that's where it stops for me, right? I'm not diving in doing any therapy. I've seen that when I refer somebody out to get therapy in addition to homeopathy, that the two tend to work so well together that mm-hmm. things tend to be like more effective and get to a generally to like a like an easier and sometimes quicker healing than either of them done alone. And in more, even like truly more complete level of healing too, than you're able to accomplish with either alone, because you're working both on the physiological side, the emotional side, like you're just, it's a more totality type of approach.
It's actually interesting you say that really quickly, because in the psychological world of education, the thing that is constantly being hammered into students who are studying psychology is therapy plus an antidepressant, therapy plus, you know, some sort of psychotropic medication is going to lead to better outcomes. And there's some data around that. My personal experience, especially working with sensitive people, is almost always those medications blunt to the point of not being able to access, you know, the person's ability to heal really deeply. And so, yeah, the symptom picture looks better because they're not feeling as much, you know, and there's a time and a place. I am not anti-medication by any means. I think that they literally save lives. What I know for certain is homeopathy does not do that.
Yeah.
So the combination of homeopathy plus the appropriate therapy for that person is just like, it's leverage on both sides.
Yeah. Not surprised that we agree. So let's shift gears, even though it sounds like there's just such a blending of things. Let's shift gears to talk a little bit more about HSPs, especially since we're going to have some people who are in our audience and our community who maybe aren't having trauma responses, but that still are HSPs that we really want to make sure we support them as well. So can you define HSP for us?
Yes. So a highly sensitive person, that's what HSP stands for, will be able to pick up on different forms of subtleties through their senses. So that can be emotional, visual, energetic, smell, touch, intuitive, even. Usually I kind of lump that in with an emotional intelligence, but sometimes it's beyond that and it's difficult to pinpoint. But we just feel things more intensely, whatever that sense may be. So that means, you know, if an emotion is a chemical reaction in our bodies, so every time I feel happy, I am having to create a neurotransmitter, the brain chemistry, to help me feel happy. That means that every time we feel an emotion, we are experiencing a chemical reaction in our bodies. So that's going to be true for all of our senses. And if a person who is highly sensitive is experiencing more emotions throughout a day, because we perceive more things, right? So I'm somebody who can walk into a room and I can feel if there is somebody that is off, right? So I can feel if somebody's having intense anger and they're not necessarily displaying it, something shifts in my own body. So now I've just generated a chemical reaction in my body. And that is exhausting over a day or weeks or months or years. So sensitive people, you may not have that emotional piece. You may have, so artists oftentimes are highly sensitive people. They see different shades of color that I couldn't see per se, right? And the way that they relate to that color is different. Or musicians, right? With different notes and keys and pitches and all of that. So sensitive people are more aware of social stimuli, very, very subtle changes in facial expressions or voice can be registered for us. Whereas for non-HSPs, it just doesn't. I'm married to a non-HSP, and for constantly, I used to think it was like some sort of, you know, gaslighting, but I have completely come to the understanding that it just does not register for him. You know, I would say, did you hear that? Did you smell that? Did you whatever? And he'll just be like, no, I didn't. And now I very much believe that that is the case. But you know, we'll be watching a movie and me and the dog are the ones that are like, wait, what was that? And so that, you know, animals tend to be much more sensitive. But even, and this is really cool, even in different species, there is research that shows that 20 to 30% of the population, whatever species you're talking about, has a group of highly sensitive people, dogs, fish, whatever. And so what we know about that, and this is what I love to talk about, you know, in transitioning towards a more empowering discussion and self-perception around sensitivity, is that we are meant to be here. There is an evolutionary benefit to us existing in societies. And we tend to be teachers, healers, we tend to be professors, or, well, that's the teacher, or clergy. So spiritual advisors, and in all of these groups, there is a higher incidence of sensitivity, and there is an ability to keep our cohorts or our groups of our communities safe, because we can sense shifts in weather. We can sense changes in potential threats, basically.
I feel like as you were explaining that, quite a few people were probably like, I'm sitting here going, wait, am I a highly sensitive person? And also, you just helped me understand my husband too. So thank you for that.
Yeah.
it makes a lot of sense. I think that, again, as Pan's moms, we don't necessarily recognize that we're highly sensitive. And it's just hard to see us in that, because I've never even thought of myself as a highly sensitive person. But as you're saying all that, I'm like, oh, wait, yes, and yes, and yes. So tell us what makes someone predisposition to being highly sensitive? Is something in hyper mode? Is it a trauma response or possibly something hormonal?
Yeah, that is, you know, I've had a lot of well-meaning colleagues talk about, you know, sensitivity is just a trauma response. Sensitivity can absolutely be a response to trauma. When your nervous system is stuck in fight or flight, it can very much look like a hyper, overly sensitive, easily overwhelmed, easily overstimulated. And that's kind of more the burnout picture, or like the shadow version of being a highly sensitive person. We don't have to live in that place. But that's, I think, when people think of a sensitive person, it's like, oh, you're easily, I like to say quickly, because we're burning through so much data, right? Overstimulated. So yes, that can look like a trauma response. Having chronic infections, you know, or covert infections where somebody doesn't know that they've got it, but they're just all of a sudden exhausted and can't remember anything, and, you know, aren't able to live their life how they used to, can look like sensitivity. The thing is, if somebody is born a highly sensitive person, they've been likely told that from the time that they were really, really young. So before hormonal changes come into play, before there is, unless they're born with a chronic infection or chronic disease, you know, then you might have to decipher that. But usually we can tell that somebody is born a highly sensitive person because they have always been really moved by music or the arts, or they have been told you were always a really sensitive child, or they startled easily from the time that they were very, very young. Now, all of those other things that you mentioned can absolutely play a role. So as that sensitive child comes into adolescence, their sensitivity is going to increase, adolescence or pregnancy or postpartum or menopause or andropause for men, it will impact the sensitivity. So there's a lot of interplay. You know, when I'm sick, I'm way more, my sensitivity goes haywire, right? Everything is brighter. Everything is louder. Everything is much more taxing than it normally is because our baselines are so much higher. So I guess genetics, you know, would be the answer to somebody actually being a highly sensitive person versus having these life experiences that might make you more sensitive. It doesn't necessarily mean that you are a highly sensitive person. Okay. So having someone in your family who's a highly sensitive person might make you more likely to be one. Doesn't mean 100% because we're only 20 to 30% of the population. So it's not going to be every child.
So we sort of talked around this in several ways, and I'm hoping maybe this is like not realistic, but I'm hoping that there's almost like a checklist of sorts for people who might not be aware that they're a highly sensitive person, because I feel like there's so many people in our community, especially that are likely HSPs. Like you said, you think you have not had a personal experience with somebody who has dealt with PANS who wasn't an HSP prior to PANS. And like, we see this, I see it with like hypersensitivity to medications and homeopathic remedies and all sorts of things like that. So what could people be looking for to help them know that maybe they're an HSP if they didn't already have a strong feeling?
Yeah. Yeah. So there is a checklist. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. I'll go through some of them, but there's research that's been conducted on this. So there's luckily a really nice resource that I can provide. But if you're somebody, and I mentioned a little bit, some of these already. So if you're somebody who has a really rich and complex inner life and is, you know, really easily moved by music and the arts, to the point of not necessarily tears, but you feel it and you're drawn to it. That's a really common sensitive person experience. Feeling quickly overwhelmed by things like bright lights or strong smells, fabrics and, you know, sensations on the body, or sirens in the environment, getting startled or rattled, really easily, or especially if you have a lot going on and you have to do a lot in a short period of time, that kind of stimulation can feel totally overloading. An aversion to violent movies or TV shows is a really common sensitive person behavior. This is actually one of the ones that's super standard for my son. And it's funny because in some ways he's really not a highly sensitive child. And in other ways, he's like the poster board or the poster child for a sensitive person. So you don't have to have all of these. You can be, you know, you can have a really strong emotional sensitivity and check all of them and not have some of the physical senses, right? So you might not have a sensitivity to sounds or to fabrics on your skin or whatever. The fabric on the skin makes me think to mention that sensory processing disorder can sometimes fall under this category or the autism spectrum. And there is quite a bit of overlap. And there are children and people who have been diagnosed with autism and are not highly sensitive. So even in something that we consider to be high sensitivity, it doesn't necessarily overlap in those cases. Either. So there is Elaine Aron is the psychologist who coined the term and has done all the research on sensitivity, on highly sensitive people. And on her website, I believe it's the hsperson.com, there is a quiz to see if you are a highly sensitive person. And it's super helpful. So those questions obviously will go through all the things that I already mentioned and as well as others. You don't have
There's probably a lot of people who are listening who have PANS kids. They're just like, well, my kid's sensitive to lights and sounds and my kid's sensitive to clothing. And like, I can't tell you how many parents will come into our Facebook group and like celebrate when the kid wears jeans. And I'm like, okay, great. But like, I don't want to wear jeans either. So like, why are we trying to force kids into jeans? Who cares? Like, right. Let's all wear soft clothes. The difference is that, like, so there could be like a baseline sensitivity, and then chronic conditions can cause flares of the sensitivity too, right? So we're wanting to look and see the fluctuating patterns too, that can also contribute to understanding how much is like your steady state and how much is like due to a stressor, an illness, etc. Like you said, when you're sick, things just like your sensitivity is gone haywire. So sensitivity isn't necessarily like a static state that's influenced by things around you.
But they won't go away, right? Yeah. So with homeopathy, when you're seeing the recovery trajectory of kids with PANS and PANDAS, it might just completely go away. And if you're an HSP, it will not go away, right? And it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's you know, you can really enjoy life in this way, but it will always be there. You will always have, your baseline will be a little bit higher.
I just wanted to share my cheat trick that I asked you about one time when I was trying to figure out whether or not I'm a highly sensitive person, and I'm grudgingly accepting that I probably am a highly sensitive person. And in spite of the fact that still bothers me a little bit, and I'm working on it.
We'll get there.
So I remember sending you a text one time that I said, is it a good test for whether you're a highly sensitive person, how you react if you go to a regular grocery store versus like, you know, Trader Joe's or like Sprouts or Whole Foods or something like that, that's like not quite as like overwhelming and just like towers of things everywhere, lots of people moving, you don't know where things are, sounds and like 10,000 choices for everything. And you said, I think the grocery store is the test for a highly sensitive person. So how you respond in a grocery store.
Yes. And the way that you create your reality, the grocery store that you choose also speaks volumes to you likely being a sensitive person, right? The way that you design your life to try to limit some of those overstimulating situations.
Yeah. So like you're saying, if you need to go to Trader Joe's on a Monday at opening, so there's nobody there and there's very few choices for things, then maybe you're a highly sensitive person.
Yes. Yes. Or AJ's in Arizona, which we don't have in Colorado, sadly, but that was like one of my happy places. It was just the lighting was really nice and calm and everybody's just in their happy place. And
what are some things in daily life that are essential for highly sensitive people?
That is one of my favorite topics. I will try to keep this really focused because the daily tending to these essential self-care behaviors is what ultimately helps to pull us out of that state of burnout, that state of chronic depletion. So the first thing that I will say is hydration, hydration, hydration. The amount of fluid that we have to move to create these extrasensory experiences is tremendous. And so every chemical reaction that I was referring to earlier, every anxious response, you know, because every time a piece of information comes into our bodies, our nervous system has to decide, is that safe or is that unsafe? So it has to engage that fight or flight response for a very brief period of time. But for us, it's like bombardment, you know, it's this constant influx of information. And so every time our fight or flight response is activated, there is a massive movement of fluid. So the detoxification that happens from that, you know, cleaning up, restoring all of the nutrients, all of that requires the movement of fluid. So hydration is number one. And of course, there are many components that go into telling you exactly how much hydration, but just consider how much caffeine am I drinking, which is also incredibly taxing, by the way, because it's dehydrating and you lose a lot of electrolytes and all of that. But am I consuming more caffeine than I am water? You know, and water is the source of hydration, not anything else, not even tea, because would you clean something with tea or would you clean it with, you know, water? And that's a really important way to distinguish what type of hydration is best. And then electrolytes help to move water in the body. So I would say electrolytes and hydration. I cannot tell you how many sensitive people have had huge turnarounds in their lives just by incorporating electrolytes and water. This is a really big piece of advice. Don't think that, oh, water. Oh yeah. Everybody talks about it. It's huge. It's huge for us sensitive people. So along with that, optimizing sleep, I know that can be a really loaded topic and charged topic, because there's many reasons why sleep might be difficult. But if it's something that you can just simply prioritize, 90% of our healing occurs during this time. So when we're talking about, you know, the depletion of our resources, making us susceptible to long-term chronic issues, just getting more sleep is going to help to refuel your tank. So hydration actually helps with that. So hydration is going to be involved in all of the things that I'm mentioning. Having regular bowel movements, having a formed and easy to pass bowel movement every single day is your body removing waste. We have more chemical reactions. That means that we have a lot more trash and a lot more stuff to clear out. So we have to make sure that that's getting out every single day. Oh my gosh, I could talk about this for a really long time. If you know that you have any kind of chronic infections, treat them aggressively, because that is just, you know, it's just tapping into all of your energy sources and boundaries. You know, we talked a little bit about toxicity and just general waste that's produced in our bodies, but relationships do that as well. And that could be your healthcare provider. That could be, I mean, there's so many different places where that could be happening. I think that there is a huge misconception, you know, that we have to be faithful to the providers that we somehow just landed with. And I'm just such a huge advocate of finding the fit. When your nervous system feels at home with the person that you're working collaboratively on your healing journey, it will be transformative for you. But of course, this also means family of origin and, you know, all of those relationships that are contributing waste into your life.
Yeah. I know that you've got an upcoming course that goes into burnout for the HSP, and you do lots of like more specific work with people, because the truth is HSPs have very different needs just in their daily life and then also in their medical needs. So we'll make sure we put links to the course or how to like get sign up to be informed about it, because I don't know if it's going to be ready by the time that we're that the podcast is airing, but they can, we'll get links to the show notes for how people can connect with you if they want to learn more about getting support for an HSP or taking your course or anything like that. Can you share with us a little bit more about the medical needs that might be different for people?
Yes.
HSPs.
Yes, that is super important. As I mentioned, the collaboration is key. And I, you know, I don't know if this is because therapy is where I started, and the healing relationship and the therapeutic clients is such an important aspect of psychology. But I cannot say enough about this. And it is the collaboration and feeling seen and heard and understood in the work that you're doing with your healthcare team is 100% the most important and first thing that you need to make sure is in place before you do any of the other things. So sensitive people, you know, the ranges that are on labs, and this sometimes happens with PANS and PANDAS, but sometimes the lab values really are that far out of range. Sensitive people notice things changing in their bodies long before the range on a lab report will flag as abnormal or diseased. Conventional medicine is really looking for diagnosing, right? So they're going to wait until those lab values are way out of the range. And for sensitive people, we can feel really, really crummy, and our lab values are perfectly within range. So working with a provider who can listen to your body and have it guide, you know, the treatment and the diagnosis and all of the care is really, really important. Our bodies are made for preventative and gentle and a collaborative approach. Sensitive people, not always, but will oftentimes have paradoxical responses to medications or even supplements, herbs. I mean, homeopathy, right? Like sensitive people sometimes will have much more robust responses or aggravations to remedies. So gentle is usually better. You know, we pick up on things more easily in our bodies, but also a little tap in the direction that our body needs to go is sometimes exactly what a sensitive person's body needs. So because of all of those extra chemical reactions, we need much higher levels of certain nutrients because we're just burning through them so quickly. And because our labs are usually within a normal range, we oftentimes carry a lot of little T's in our experience with the medical profession because conventional doctors are waiting for these to be in a diseased range. And so we go to doctor after doctor after doctor. Something's not right. Something's not right. I have a natural health for highly sensitive people Facebook group. And there are a handful of people that have shared their stories about how one person had a tumor. She had a brain tumor. They couldn't find it. And she knew. She just knew. And she kept going to doctors and saying, I have a brain tumor. Please, you know, do an MRI, do scans. And all of her lab values were normal. And it wasn't until she finally found a provider that would listen to her that did a brain scan, found the brain tumor, had to have it removed. It was obviously a huge and very traumatic experience for her. But that's a really common, I mean, that's an extreme example, but it's also really very common.
Yeah.
That is why you need a provider that listens and trusts that you know what's happening with your body.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, how do we talk to our healthcare providers about being a highly sensitive person? It's almost like talking to them about homeopathy. I feel like going at it feels a little awkward.
Right. Oh my gosh. That's a really good comparison. It is very similar to that. And it is awkward because, you know, it's really similar. That's a very good point. If somebody knows about homeopathy, if somebody knows about being a highly sensitive person, it's not usually positive, right? Like in the conventional world, it's oftentimes not seen in a positive light, you know, because of whatever preconceptions there are. So, oh, you're sensitive. Oh, great. Now I have to work with a sensitive person and all of their demands and all of their weird symptoms. So it can be challenging to find a provider who understands and is willing to learn, right? So my first recommendation would be find a provider who is aware and understands and is even certified. So in that same website, the HS person, Dr. Elaine Aaron, has a whole section on medical providers and psychologists who are trained and certified highly sensitive person providers. That would be one resource. If for whatever reason that is not possible for you, because in your area there is no HSP certified provider, then you would want to start with the provider who actually sits and listens to you. And then if they are listening, introduce the concept, right? So a lot of this comes from your own knowledge of yourself and of what a highly sensitive person is so that you can advocate and educate for yourself, educate them about you and what it is that this is about. But starting with somebody who's already not listening, I would not waste my time, honestly, because then, you know, one of the best ways to not end up with long-term chronic trauma response is to prevent the trauma from happening. And if you're working with somebody who is not listening already, then more than likely they are not going to be open to hearing about being a sensitive person. And then that will be more invalidating and not a good trajectory there.
Yeah.
So collaboration is what you're looking for.
Well, Dr. Lamb, I feel like I know we're very, very limited on our amount of time that we've got left to wrap up this conversation. And of course we saved the question about how to parent an HSP for the absolute last. And I know that the reality is that we could probably have an entire hour long conversation on this topic alone. So we might have to ask you kindly to come back and talk to us about this topic, perhaps in the future, because I know we don't have time to really dig into it today. Do you have any really quick takeaways for things that people should consider or resources people should look into if they believe that they have an HSP child and how to parent?
Yeah. So one of the most important things to remember is that all children will couple their nervous systems with their parents. And so the work that the parent does on their own to regulate their own nervous system is going to be one of the most powerful tools that you have in parenting your child. So that's number one. So that might mean therapeutic interventions for the parent on learning how to do that, and then how to tie it together with their child, because they're already doing that. Mm-hmm. They're already doing that. But if our nervous system is in a state of stress or panic, and they're coupling into that, then the effects are not, you know, the desired outcome. So the way to shift that is to really be intentional about our own nervous system state. Aside from that, a lot of validation. I hear you. I know this feels really scary. I know that was really loud. I know that whatever it is that they're saying is real, even if you can't see it or hear it or understand it, just saying your experience is true. And that helps their nervous systems to calm and settle. And then from there, they're going to be a lot more flexible in making shifts and adjustments to whatever the request is at the time. They're going to have unique nutritional needs, you know, so understanding that their need for magnesium and electrolytes and hydration is going to be higher. And because they're little, they're not going to be probably very interested in drinking a lot of water. So being the parent that is saying this is important for you and educating them on why, you know, that is. So the whole chemical reaction piece and all of that we talked about today. Emphasizing sleep. Sensitive people typically have a higher requirement for sleep. So really creating a schedule that allows the child to be able to go to sleep earlier. We know that the majority of the time that we spend in bed asleep before midnight is going to be the most therapeutic because of the way the symphony of hormones that are functioning for us at that time. So most really young kids should be in bed and asleep by 7 p.m., especially a sensitive child. So that way, if they wake up super early, which I know stinks as the parent, but they are allowed to determine how much time they need for sleep, right? They could sleep all the way until 9 a.m. if they need to, or unfortunately wake up at 5.
Yeah.
like mine did so many times. And then in terms of resources, there's a book called The Highly Sensitive Child by Elaine Aron. She's like my go-to because there's not a lot of literature out there that is really backed by science, and hers is. And there's also A Highly Sensitive Parent. And I loved that book. It was so incredibly validating for me as a sensitive parent. And then for older kids, there are books on growth mindset for boys growth mindset for girls. And that really helps them to learn how to invest in resilience for themselves. So I love those books.
If you can give me the specific titles, we would love to put links to them in our show notes.
Yeah, absolutely.
For boys and girls. Well, Dr. Lamb, thank you so much for your time and your expertise today in talking about these two very important topics for our community and for the world at large. You know, it's not just the PANS PANDAS community that struggles with trauma and being highly sensitive. So I'm grateful that you were here to talk about this. And I hope that you get lots of opportunities to share to lots of different communities, because these are things that really affect every single human being, period. Right. How can people get in touch with you or follow you to learn more about today?
Yeah, so my website is drkarenlamb.com or purevitanaturalmedicine.com, either of those. You can text us directly at 303-803-7734. And if you want a link to the Facebook group, that can be sent to you through there.
We can put that in the links too.
Those are pretty much, I mean, I'm on social media kind of, but it's primarily the Facebook group. That's really where I spend most of my time online.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, again,
it was fun. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks, everybody. Bye.
We hope you found this episode helpful, hopeful, and inspiring. We try to get a new episode out every week. You can make sure you don't miss any by following us on Spotify or subscribing to our channel on YouTube. If you want to connect with us more, join our Facebook group, Homeopathy for PANS and PANDAS, where we have exclusive weekly videos and answer your questions about, you guessed it, homeopathy for PANS and PANDAS throughout the week. If you are already a member, give us a shout out and let us know what you thought about this episode. If you aren't on Facebook and would like to reach us, you can email us at podcast@resiliencenaturopathic.com. Until next time, take care and remember, this won't be forever.